Today's programme, the challenge facing Lebanon's winemakers and the rapidly growing epicentre of contemporary French art. But first we go to India. Narendra Modi will begin an historic third term today as Prime Minister in the world's largest democracy, making him only the second politician after independence to win three general elections in a row. But Modi does not enjoy a parliamentary majority, and he will have to rely on allies to govern, making his premiership much more difficult. Sajida Momin reports.
Narendra Modi will be sworn in today as Prime Minister of India for a third straight term in New Delhi's Grand Presidential Palace called the Rashtrapati Bhavan. But there is no doubt that he has fallen to the earth from the sky where he was comfortably perched until the results of the general elections in the world's largest democracy were announced this week. And he fell with a loud thud that will echo for months to come, despite Modi occupying the Prime Minister's chair once again. The voters have cut Modi and his party down to size. Both Modi and his Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, are in big trouble because the BJP no longer commands a parliamentary majority. Modi will now have to run the government with the help of two allies who have a sordid history of switching sides. The political parties Modi will have to depend on for survival, the Telugu Desam Party and the Janata Dal United Party, are led by the wily Nitish Kumar and Chandrababu Naidu, whose life's ambition is to be the Prime Minister themselves. They wouldn't hesitate to suddenly withdraw support if they stand to gain by pulling down Modi's government. Both are thoroughly unpredictable and don't have any ideological compunctions worth the name. Modi's aura of invincibility and unchallenged supremacy, thanks to the BJP's brute majority after the 2014 and 2019 elections, lies in tatters today, as Modi is now at the mercy of his power-hungry coalition partners. The road ahead for India is strewn with uncertainties and twists at every turn, which doesn't bode well for the country's economy. Uncertainties are bound to dampen the mood of foreign investors, adversely affecting growth, development, and progress, which India badly needs. Importantly, the electoral blow will also make Modi shaky and less confident on the global stage, which had increasingly become his second home because of his fondness for publicity and rubbing shoulders with world leaders to impress domestic audiences and outshine his rivals at home. He made a big deal out of the G20 summit last year and milked it to the last drop, but it doesn't seem to have paid any electoral dividends, considering the BJP's failure to reach the halfway mark of 272 MPs in Parliament. It bagged only 240 seats, 63 less than its tally 5 years ago. The early signs of trouble are there for everyone to see. Modi was scheduled to take the oath of office yesterday, but it was rescheduled for today on the pretext that leaders from neighbouring countries like Bangladesh, Nepal, Sri Lanka, Bhutan, Maldives and Mauritius, invited to witness the swearing-in ceremony, needed more time to pack their bags and travel to New Delhi. Insiders, however, say that Modi's swearing-in was delayed by a day because of squabbling allies demanding their pound of flesh. There are multiple reports of frayed tempers and hard bargaining for key government ministries, as the BJP now has no option but to allocate many lucrative portfolios to its allies. Power brokers and wheeler dealers are having a field day after the BJP failed to clinch a majority in the elections. It was expected to sweep, but eventually didn't. But among the uncertainties, one thing is crystal clear. Modi's government will have to deal with a rejuvenated and aggressive opposition bloc that was missing since 2014, giving Modi the freedom to do what he liked. This time, while the BJP-led alliance of 13 partners has the strength of 293 in Parliament, the opposition led by the Congress Party have 233 seats. 17 lawmakers are not aligned with either coalition. Hence, the opposition is now in a position to hold the government to account, a reality Modi and company will have difficulty getting accustomed to after bulldozing and steamrolling the opposition during the previous two terms in power. Before the votes were counted, Modi was riding so high that he brazenly announced he was not born biologically, but sent by God to save India from ruin. as he takes guard today for a third innings at the country's helm without a parliamentary majority and dependent on crutches, he could well be ruining the day he made it all about himself. For World Report, I'm Sajida Momin in India.
Next we go to Lebanon and the fertile Bekaa Valley east of Beirut towards the border with Syria. It is Lebanon's winemaking region, but workers there have had to grapple with myriad problems. An economy in distress, a conflict on the southern border, a failed banking system and climate change, which is now an existential crisis for the wine industry, as Hannah McCarthy reports.
The red rock-strewn soil of the vineyard contrasts with the nearby wheat fields that carpet much of Lebanon's Bekaa Valley. In the distance are the likely snow-capped Haramun Mountains that straddle the border with neighbouring Syria. For centuries, this region, with its high altitude, mild winters and long summers, has attracted winemakers, while in more recent decades, its strategic location near the porous border with Syria has enticed the Iran-backed militant group Hezbollah to take control of this fertile valley where most of Lebanon's wine is produced. The 2006 war between Hezbollah and Israel broke out as the annual grape harvest was due to begin, says Tarek Sakhar, the technical director of the Lebanese winemaker Chateau Mazar, which owns the vineyard we're standing in. Israeli rockets struck the Bekaa Valley on several occasions in 2006, but Sakhar feared only for the ripened Chardonnay grapes that would quickly rot if left on their stems. With drones flying overhead and burnt-out cars lying by the wayside, Sakhar drove to a nearby village and rang the bell of a local church to gather a team for the wartime harvest. With military speed, the workers hand-picked the grapes and stowed them on trucks to transfer to the Chateau Mazar winery for fermentation, blending and bottling. When I asked if the risk had been strictly necessary, Sakhar gestured to some young vines laden with small berries. "They are my children," he replies. "You have to be resilient. You have to continue to work whatever the consequences," says a man willing to risk everything for a dry and medium-bodied Chardonnay. Fortunately for Sakhar and his team, the harvest was over when the latest war between Hamas and Israel erupted in October. The bloody conflict quickly spread to Lebanon's southern border, triggering near daily exchanges of fire between Israeli forces and Hezbollah, an ally of Hamas. Earlier this year, Israeli rockets struck the Bekaa Valley, targeting Hezbollah's weapon depots. So far, none of the attacks have been near the vineyards, but it's enough to frighten off visitors. With a destabilizing conflict on its border, a failed banking system, and a weak government in Beirut, there are no shortage of problems for winemakers in Lebanon to grapple with. There is an even more existential one which looms over the wine industry, one of the few exporting sectors in the struggling and import-reliant Lebanese economy. The damaging fallout from climate change means that summer is lasting longer in Lebanon, with the hottest days reaching ever higher temperatures and leading to frequent wildfires, which are barely kept at bay by an ill-resourced civil guard. Heatwaves once happened every 10 years, says Sakhar, but are now occurring every 2 to 3 years and destroying up to 10% of his grape crop. Globally, land suitable for growing wine could halve by 2050 if current levels of carbon emissions do not decrease. Winemakers in Bekaa have adapted by focusing on heat-loving grapes such as Cinsault, Syrah and Tempranillo. Fans of Lebanese Cabernet Sauvignon may be sorry to learn that it's a victim of the hotter climate. With a small berry, the grapes easily dry up in extreme heat, leaving little but overly sweetened and highly alcoholic resin more suited for molasses than fine red wine. White wine too is a casualty of increasing temperatures, with its acidity and crisp flavour evaporating in the heat that pushes grapes too quickly through their natural growth cycle. The rainy season in Lebanon has also become shorter, and over the next 2 decades, annual rainfall in Lebanon is estimated to fall by 10 to 20%. Some winemakers use irrigation to manage the now frequent droughts, but the watering technique is seen as dishonest by natural winemakers like Sakhar, who says irrigation dilutes the flavour of wine that should reflect yearly climatic variations. "Honest, truthful wine should reflect what's happened during the year," says Sakhar philosophically. But with the region hotter and increasingly unstable, it's hard to know what this year's vintage from Lebanon will taste like. For World Report in the Bekaa Valley, I'm Hannah McCarthy.
Finally, we go to Paris. The French capital still ranks among the great artistic centres of the world, but it is one of the off-maligned suburbs of Romainville in Seine-Saint-Denis that a rapidly growing new epicentre of contemporary French art is to be found, as Connor Power reports.
When we think of Paris, we often think of culture, art and sophistication. Amongst the large cities of the world, it is, arguably, the most beautiful, with a uniform prettiness and grandeur, much of which was built in the latter half of the 19th century. It was at this point that the French capital began to affirm itself as the world centre of artistic creation. Today, Paris still packs quite a punch from an aesthetic and world art point of view, but the city has outgrown the original one, and the suburbs, or banlieues, have a combined population of around 10 million people, a multiple of Paris's population of approximately 2.6 million. And while policy for some time has been to consider Greater Paris as the real Paris, the images from the banlieue are rarely positive. Films about Paris tend to focus on human drama, on romance, with lots of beautiful shots of the world's most beautiful large city. Films set in the banlieue, in contrast, tend to be about social unrest, riots and drug-related crime, with lots of panning shots of ugly modern buildings. But in the heart of the huge suburban department of Seine-Saint-Denis, and located in an ugly tall building that used to be at the heart of a pharmaceutical factory, a revolutionary new force of artistic creation is perhaps the greatest symbol of what the Parisian suburbs really have to offer, giving us a glimpse of what the dream of Grand Paris can be. The main building in the Fimenco Foundation is the site of what used to be the heater that provided hot water to the enormous plant in Romainville, Seine-Saint-Denis. "We started 5 years ago," explains Agnès Gonim, communications officer with the foundation, "but that was during COVID, so we are really only open 3 years. At one point, this factory employed over 5,000 people. When it closed in 2013, the impact for the local community was significant at a time when the Seine-Saint-Denis department had an unemployment rate of almost 13%. Today, the site is full of activity, with artists, clerical staff, workers and tradesmen focused on very different objectives. Agnès takes me past the 14-metre-high chimney that lies idle, standing tall above the roof of the main building, the Bâtiment Chauve-Eau. It was, she says, always very important to keep the buildings here more or less as they were, not to demolish and rebuild, but to respect the industrial architecture of them and transform their use. On first glance, the main art exhibition space looks very much like an abandoned industrial building, with its enormous dimensions, tall windows, and a ceiling that seems to go on for stories. When you see the resident artist's work displayed here, however, you see how it all makes sense. The space here means that the sky is the limit for any sculpture or art piece you want to display. Enormous silk screen prints adorn part of one of the artist's pieces, and the scale of the work looks almost limitless. Although this was set up ostensibly for the people of the town of Romainville, it is, as Agnès explains, open to everyone and to the whole world. The facilities are there for all disciplines and they are superb. From the ceramic room to the print room, nothing is wanting here for the visiting creative artists who come from the locality and from all over the world. We don't have any collections and we don't ask artists to donate work, says Agnès. Many artists come here and work in one particular discipline, says her colleague Samantha Bergognon, but they often end up trying other disciplines, because the facilities here are so good, and the philosophy is to open up to every kind of artistic expression. We work our way through the enormous building housing residence quarters and workshops, through the common room and out onto the balcony of the roof, a terrace that would easily grace any city centre hotel in the French capital. From here, the view to the east is a suburban industrial cityscape, but all the visible buildings belong to the Fimenco Foundation. 2 blocks away, the new world-class theatre is nearing completion and due to open in the third quarter of this year. Another block destined for the storage of artworks is almost finished. Beyond that, another newly refurbished building will house short-term resident artists. After only 3 years of operation, the FRAC Île-de-France, the contemporary art funding organisation for the entire Île-de-France region, which includes Paris and the entirety of its vast suburbs, decided to move its headquarters here out of its original location in central Paris. That officially put this banlieue at the epicentre of contemporary French art. What I've seen already involves a scale of size and of facilities that could be found nowhere in Ireland. But looking out from the rooftop of the residency building, it's clear that this is only the beginning of a much larger and unique artistic hub that has already put Romainville and Seine-Saint-Denis on the cultural map of this vast country where art is taken very seriously. For RTÉ World Report in Romainville, Seine-Saint-Denis, this is Conor Power.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.